Stalin is still popular, even now that we know all the atrocities that happened.
It was a very unfair society. There were stores which had practically nothing.
The Soviet system tried to eliminate anyone who was different.
Russia was a very closed society in those days.
Gorbachev himself was very enthusiastic about destroying the past, but they did not understand what they're supposed to create.
More shocking was the idea that the Communist Party could be dissolved or mightn't be the ruling force.
How often do you get to live in a world in which the country you were born in really doesn't exist anymore?
Death of an Empire.
Иван Кудрявцев. Итак, в центре Москвы продолжается
сцепление. To the streets of Russia's biggest cities.
Permission for a demonstration of up to 30,000 people.
Developing story, over a dozen people have been arrested.
Moscow has seen nothing like this for years. Two nights of anti-government protests.
Protesters on the streets of Moscow in December, calling for an end to the rule of Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. They're calling, too, for free and open elections. Since the disputed parliamentary elections on December the 4th, Russians have been on the streets. 12 years ago, on March 27th, the age of Vladimir Putin began when he was elected president of the Russian Federation.
He announced that Vladimir Putin has been elected president of the country. In a statement, the commission said that with 94% of the ballots counted, Mr. Putin had secured 52.5% of the vote.
Even then, the election was challenged by the communist opposition, who lost out. Putin's character dominates our final episode in Death of an Empire. His decision to seek a third presidential nomination, combined with the irregularities in the December elections, proved the trigger for the current wave of anti-government protests.
It named Vladimir Putin as its candidate. He will try to return to the presidency.
But just who is this man who has shaped modern Russia? And how did he come to hold such power? He was born in humble circumstances in what was then Leningrad in 1952 and made his career in the KGB from 1975. He left active service only after the 1991 failed coup against Gorbachev. One of his former university lecturers, Anatoly Sobchak, later became his political mentor. Sobchak was mayor of Leningrad and was instrumental in shaping Putin's political career. Boris Yeltsin brought him into his administration, and by 1999, he was Yeltsin's prime minister. Later, he was nominated as Yeltsin's successor.
Putin builds absolutely corrupted state with one-party system, without competition, without elections, without independent of court system, without freedom of speech, without real opportunity for young generation to achieve something.
Boris Nemtsov is a member of the opposition and a strong critic of Putin's rule.
Especially if you are not from Moscow or St. Petersburg, it's strictly impossible. That's why a rich country with billions of dollars for gas and oil export have 25 million of poor people with incomes less than $3 per day. Do you think that this is what Russia needs? I don't think so.
People like Nemtsov make the case that under Putin, opposition parties are suppressed. They're simply not allowed to register for the elections. The parliamentary elections on December the 4th gave Putin's party, United Russia, 49%. But parties led by people like Nemtsov, the People's Freedom Party, were, like many others, rejected and simply not allowed on the ballot paper.
No registration, no freedom of speech. I'm in the blacklist on TV. Not only me, but a lot of opposition leaders. All of them are in the blacklist. He's very afraid of competition. He's afraid to lose his power.
Edward Limonov led the now-banned extreme right-wing National Bolshevik Party.
For the 8 years of Putin's rule of Russia, in my party, about 180 people went through the prisons and camps. 9 people been killed.
He is now a leader of Another Russia, a grouping that includes people of various allegiances. Limonov and Nemtsov may be coming from opposite political poles, but they're both part of the current anti-government protests.
It's very simple. What we want free elections, And then formation of coalition government, because I strongly believe that no party could have the majority after the free elections.
Kathy Lally, the bureau chief of the Washington Post in Moscow, sees Putin as a creation of the economic chaos of the 90s.
He made a pretty explicit deal with Russians, which was give up some of your freedoms and you'll have order and stability. So he pretty quickly went about dismantling a lot of what had been done to the good in the 90s. He made governors appointed instead of elected, and this included many mayors as well as governors. And in general, people did not complain. And still, even as the country has become more authoritarian, people still have the freedom to travel. They can sit in their kitchens and complain about Putin as bitterly as they like and don't have to worry about the neighbors informing on them.
Sofia Kishkovsky is an American journalist of Russian descent, now based in Moscow for the New York Times. Putin's hard man reputation was carefully molded. But after 12 years, the public tide of support is turning against him.
I mean, it's kind of like a Greek tragedy. Actually, it is a Greek tragedy. He had all this power handed to him, and now it's slipping away. And I think he and his circle, they don't know what to do.
But while Putin is now seen as an authoritarian figure, in his early years, he was looked on by many Russians as the provider of stability, and especially economic stability after the turbulence of the Yeltsin years. His heavy-handed response to military and political challenges were often seen as the price people had to pay for that stability.
A large part of the population would think it's a good thing. It's against stability.
Olga Artemova-Herns says Putin was popular because of his perceived toughness.
People are very cynical now. They realize there is corruption and the government people make a lot of money out of whatever normal people and pay it out and leave this lives of millionaires. But they feel if somebody new will come with promises, there will be only promises.
Mullingar man Chris Weaver is the chief economic strategist for Troika Sberbank in Moscow. He's been living in Russia for over 13 years. He describes how Putin created a decade of economic stability with annual growth of 7% from 1998 to 2008.
In that period, Russia earned approximately $1.5 trillion from exporting oil and gas. By raising the volume, this was Putin when he became president, he prioritized fixing the oil industry because he understood that this was Russia's cash flow. So in his first year, in 2000, he went around the country basically forcing the oil executives to stop playing their oligarch games and to focus on fixing the oil pipes and fixing the oil wells, in other words, to raise production because the country needed the cash flow and that's the only place they were going to get it. And that was very successful. And then from that $1.5 trillion, we've had this massive increase in consumer spending and consumer wealth. Now, on a relative basis, it's been massive. For example, in 1998-99, the average monthly salary in Russia was $50. Today, it's more like just under $800. That's had a very significant impact on what you see physically in the city and on the streets, this whole explosion in restaurants and fancy hotels and the number of cars on the roads, already the world's biggest mobile phone market by penetration.
Walking around Moscow today, you see the physical signs of that economic transition from communism to capitalism. In shopping malls, there are designer stores like Prada, Gucci. On the roads, there is the top-of-the-range Mercedes-Benz and BMW cars. And the sighting of a Rolls-Royce is not all that infrequent. But while Chris Weaver describes this sustained period of growth, the other side of the coin is corruption. And there's growing anger over that corruption.
Corruption does now rank as the number one concern, and people do have this cynical attitude that you can't do anything without paying a bribe, and people at the top will always take the best opportunities. And that's having an effect on the economy, and that's beginning to have an effect on how we're looking at the next phase of Russia's development. If you like, the oil advantage has been used.
The real problem now has shifted into the official corruption.
For the Dublin-based economist, Konstantin Gurdjieff, corruption is the number one issue holding Russia back.
At the state level itself, there is a lot of corruption amongst the power elites, amongst the ministries, and it goes all the way up and down the whole chain of the command, from the ordinary policeman in the street all the way to the top brass.
The whole system is corrupt, and if you take the corruption out, the whole system might collapse.
Lena Firsova used to work with me in the Irish Times.
Corruption is sort of one of the pillars of the economy that was created. So I think it's a very hard job, but it has to be done because it impedes the normal development of the country's economy. They say it's impossible to start your own business or to get anywhere without bribing officials.
The first pictures of the Chechens are threatening to kill hundreds of their hostages.
If Putin's first decade was defined by economic growth and stability, it came hand in hand with a hardline approach on the war in Chechnya and on terrorism.
Members of the group are shown with what are said to be banks full of explosives around their waist.
In October 2002, 50 Chechen rebels took over a packed Moscow theatre. They held 700 people hostage.
Outside, the authorities sit and wait, unsure what to do.
After a 2.5-day siege, Russian special forces pumped an unknown chemical agent into the theatre and then raided it. 170 died. Most of them were killed by the toxic substance. In 2004, Chechen guerrillas led by Shamil Basayev took over a school in Beslan in North Ossetia. They demanded that Russia withdraw from Chechnya. In the storming of the school, 334 people died. 186 of them were children. The Putin administration's hard line on terrorism went hand in hand with control of the media. Many journalists died. One of those who was killed was a man I knew very well, Yuri Shekhochikhin. Yuri was a journalist at Novaya Gazeta, where he was deputy editor. Yuri was an investigative journalist in the Soviet era, but ironically, it was when he started looking at corruption in the new Russia that he was killed. Andrei, good to meet you here. We're at the grave of Yuri Shekhochikhin, which is quite a remarkable, very artistic headstone. Yuri Shekhochikhin, 1950-2003. He was a very, very good guy. When I was back in Moscow, I visited Yuri's grave with Andrei Mironov, the human rights activist who we heard in the first episode. We brought some of Yuri's favourite Armenian brandy. It's the Russian tradition to leave a glass at the grave.
I remember how my brother told me Shekhochikhin died. That time I was hurt, a serious brain concussion, I think, in connection with what we were doing together with Yuri, and I was thinking to call Yuri to ask somehow to intervene, and then suddenly my brother told me he died. It was quite a shock because he was absolutely healthy and more alive than many of us. With his character, he was involved in very different serious investigations, including apartment block explosions in Moscow, also high-level corruption within KGB or FSB, as it's called now. So there were many reasons to kill him, and then even officials recognized he was poisoned to death.
And it's pretty certain, I think even the Putin administration are admitting that he was poisoned.
In October 2006,
the outspoken journalist, human rights activist, and Putin critic Anna Politkovskaya was killed.
Gunned down outside her Moscow apartment.
Journalist shot four times in the lift outside her flat.
Putin believes that journalists, independent journalists, are enemies.
Boris Nemtsov.
When Politkovskaya was killed, he said that her death destroyed his reputation more than her critical articles. No words that he apologized, that he do investigate, nothing. Just her death destroyed him.
Dmitry Strosky is a journalism professor in Yekaterinburg.
I see that media freedom is getting more and more shrinked, so I'm not very pleased about the political situation, also understanding that economic situation might be better compared to the last 10 to 15 years. And because newspapers belong to new proprietors who certainly benefited from Putin politics, but it doesn't have much common about real democracy.
While the Medvedev-Putin tandem strictly controls broadcasting, the internet has provided a free flow of ideas and opinions. It has given rise also to bloggers like Alexei Navalny, who is now at the center of the anti-government protest movement. Here he is addressing the December 24th rally in Moscow. Navalny's following has come from exposing corruption.
That's the main thing that he's doing. He has a group of lawyers and accountants that investigate companies with government capital, trying to figure out where and how dirty dealings took place.
Andrei Zolotov is chief editor of Russia Profile.
So that is a very clear kind of distinction. Dirk Sauer, the founder of Independent Media, which is the publisher of the Moscow Times, Vedomosti, the most influential business daily, once said to me in an interview, well, in Russia, there is freedom of the press for the informed and no freedom of the press for the uninformed.
The current wave of protests shows the power of online media. About 50% of the Russian public is online. And Sergei Tarutin, a Muscovite who set up a Russian language newspaper here in Ireland, sees social media as the counterbalance to official censorship.
We are developing our action on Facebook. We are announcing the people via Twitter, and we showed the world the true story about YouTube. The only problem with Russia, still not many people connected yet.
Dmitry Strovsky agrees that while the internet is free, the reality is that there are many people who don't have computers to access the internet.
I will give you an example. I live in a city having a population of 1.5 million. But going beyond the city, about 50, 60 kilometers, you will find an absolutely different picture.
In 2008, Vladimir Putin had served 2 terms as president, the maximum allowed by the constitution. He supported the presidency of Dmitry Medvedev.
Can Medvedev move out from the shadow of Putin and assert his authority?
Well, that's the million or billion ruble dollar question.
Many see the Medvedev presidency as a mere continuation of Putin's rule. In May 2008, just a few weeks after Medvedev's election as president, Russia had its first win in the Eurovision Song Contest with Dima Bilan and the song Believe. Dermot Fleming is an Irish journalist who moved to Moscow in 2008. It was a time when economic crisis had hit the US and Western Europe, but Russian pride was riding high.
Putin's Russia from 2008 was a place that seemed to have a lot more economic hope and optimism than it does at the moment. Now there's a fear that there's a return to big state-controlled industries, or that the best forms of self-advancement are to work for the government and to be connected to the centre of power. And that is something that people now feel is a return to the old days. There is a significant brain drain from Russia, as well as a big capital outflow too, that the Russian rich are not confident enough in their own domestic economy to invest in it. These are people with serious money, with billions, who decided safer to put it abroad than to leave it in Russia. So if you don't have confidence in your economy at that level, it's not healthy for the country in the long term.
Being Irish, he says, has been a bonus. His love of Irish music has provided him with an open door in Moscow.
Once you start talking to people, many of them speak English, you begin to get to know what they're like, and the sense of them being this cold, distant, dour people really doesn't fit the reality. There is a great intensity about how the Russians approach things. So some of them have then taken their interest from hearing the music, or just hearing the Pogues or the Dubliners or Irish traditional music, into a situation where they've learnt the music, where they come to Ireland, and some of them have even learnt the Irish language.
But 20 years after the end of the Soviet Union, what do young people make of the past? How do they see their world?
My name is Victoria Kolesnichenko. I'm from Krocheva Circassian Republic. I'm 17 years old. I've heard a lot about it because my grandma and my mother, they respect these periods in our history. So I used to believe that that time was really great, and now I really respect it. But at the same time, I don't like our Communist Party now. So I know that that time was the time of tolerant people who respected other people despite their nations. And that is really important because things are getting worse in our country, I think.
My name is Elena Sorokin. I'm 22 years old. I've been told about this by my parents and by my grandparents and other relatives. The most discussed point was that it was a very hard economic situation in the end of 80s and the beginning of 90s. I cannot remember anything positive.
We have freedom now. I mean, we can go abroad without problems, and at the same time, we can start our career wherever we want. And I think that life in Russia is getting better because of these opportunities.
People have a little more opportunities now to develop and to travel abroad, and they have access to economic benefits now. And I think the economic situation has got much better. Really, every person has a feeling that he is important for the country.
Yelena Fyrsova believes a lot was lost when the Soviet Union came to an end.
It's definitely good that people can freely travel abroad and that young people have more opportunities now, that's for sure, especially in big cities, and that this free market initiative can develop. But at the same time, it was not necessary to destroy the whole country by implementing the reform, that's for sure. That it was too much was destroyed. And also, we now resemble a developing country with that class of oligarchs that appeared and the gap between the people with very high incomes and people with low incomes is very high. And this creates problems for stability of the country.
While much of the focus of our series has been on the shaping of modern Russia, the fate of the other parts of the old Soviet Union has been mixed over the past 20 years. The Baltic states have become active members of the EU. There's little good news amongst other former republics, though, and Moldova, where Ron Hill started his Soviet studies, has become the poorest country in Europe.
You look at Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Georgia, Azerbaijan, even Ukraine has had a very turbulent post-Soviet history. Big country as big as France, potentially very wealthy, yet divided between the Russian-speaking East and South and the North and West Ukrainian-speaking, and they don't see eye to eye on very much, as far as I can see. You have frozen conflicts in Georgia between Armenia and Azerbaijan over Nagorno-Karabakh. In Moldova, a tiny little country, smaller than Ireland, yet there's a breakaway union. Democracy is a very fragile flower, it seems to me, and trying to build it on 60 years or 600 years of authoritarian culture is a very difficult problem.
For Chris Weaver, the future of Russia largely depends on whether the political hierarchy can tackle the issues of corruption and fuel economic growth.
Some days you get up being optimistic and go to bed pessimistic, and then the next day you reverse it again. And it really depends on what you look at. So you can be depressed about issues like continuing corruption, which appears to be getting worse rather than better, despite the fact that it's been talked about a lot. But the evidence is it's actually getting worse. Russia, which in the Soviet Union was self-sufficient and a net exporter of food products, now imports close to 50% of its food consumption, and the same in medicines. There needs to be a massive investment in infrastructure in Russia over the next several years. The reason why I'm optimistic that this will happen is because if it doesn't happen, and given that the oil advantage has been used, if it doesn't happen, then Russia is looking more like an economic growth of 2.5% to 3% for the next 10 years, rather than the 5% to 5.5% that it needs. And if we get that low level of growth, then you're going to feed into disappointing people's expectations. You're going to have probably an acceleration on social dissatisfaction. The support for the ruling United Russia Party is just falling away. You're already seeing dissatisfaction, cynicism and rejection of kind of these politics. And the fear is that that will get a lot worse if the economy grows at this low level.
This will be a dramatic year. Russia faces into a period of uncertainty. Vladimir Putin is likely to be re-elected president in March, but facing a lot of turbulence in his new term in the Kremlin. In 2012 and beyond, the space once occupied by the Soviet Union will be the one to watch.